so many people that are suffering, that feel like they're isolated, they feel stressed out, they feel angry, they feel depressed, they feel sad, they feel like their life is hopeless and helpless. Mm. And it's because they don't have a connection to their true self. I mean, like, and the yes. universe, like my teacher literally wouldn't leave the house because we would ask him, like, hey, do you want to go out and do something with us? He'd be like, well, I need to leave the house. There's a whole universe inside of me to explore. So it was like, that's what people are missing.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Ollie Smith, Atman Smith, and Andres Gonzalez on the podcast. Brothers Ollie and Atman met Andres at the University of Maryland College Park. During the last semester, the trio spent a lot of time reading books on spirituality, philosophy, history, politics, and other related topics. At the same time, they began their yoga practice and developed it under the guidance of Ollie and Atman's godfather. Months of hard work and planning ensued before they finally co-founded the Holistic Life Foundation. Together, they tell their story of how yoga and mindfulness have transformed countless communities in their amazing book called Let Your Light Shine. I love that title so much. In this episode, I talked to Ollie, Andres, and Atman about mindfulness and education. For 20 years, they've been teaching yoga and wellness to underserved kids, resulting in a decrease in suspensions and fights and an increase in attendance and grades. But it's not just about the numbers. For these gentlemen, what matters even more is changing the school's culture to become a loving and empathetic space for all by teaching stillness and introspection. I had so much fun chatting with these guys. They are so compassionate, caring, and freaking cool. I can't wait to hang out with them more. I know after listening to this podcast, you're going to want to hang out with them more as well. So without further ado, I bring you Ollie, Andres, and Atman. Hey guys, I'm so glad to have you here on the Psychology Podcast. How y'all doing? Don't all talk at once.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It's really an honor to be on here.
Definitely is.
It's an honor for me. You know, I read your book, Let Your Light Shine, How Mindfulness Can Empower Children and Rebuild Communities. And I, like, page after page, it like filled me up with hope. Filled me up with like hope for humanity. We need this way of thinking so much more in our society right now. I thought we could kind of just start with going one by one, you know, and each one of you just kind of just introduce yourselves to our audience and why you got into this at all. I mean, we could start random here. So Ollie Smith, tell me about yourself.
So I'm Ollie. I'm from Baltimore. I got into this stuff because my dad decided that me and my brother were going to get into it. We didn't really have a choice. He was a coach. He was a tough dude. He was a disciplinarian, but he was also the one that taught us to meditate. So when we were kids, he forced us to learn how to meditate. Like, he was practicing TM at the time, transcendental meditation. That was what we practiced at home. We joined a church that was a Self-Realization Fellowship Church, and it was the Divine Life Church of Absolute Monism and became the Divine Life Church of Absolute Oneness. So we meditated in church. We did subjective meditation there, Kriya Yoga stuff, and then got out of our practice when our parents got divorced, but our godfather, who we've known since we were born, was one of those people that got into yoga in the 60s and never got out of it, and decided that we went to him and asked him to teach us. He said, yeah, and then we just started soaking it up from there. So I think it was like all these different moments in my life that were kind of leading towards doing something with contemplative practice, yoga, meditation, breath work, and sharing it with people.
That's strong. So wait, who's Uncle Will? Is that Uncle Will?
Yeah, that's our godfather. His Will Joyner was
Uncle Will, right?
Yeah, Uncle Will. Yeah. He's our godfather.
I want to make sure I'm thinking of the right person. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the you'll hear us say Uncle Will a lot probably during the time we're talking with you, and when we hang and we come hang in person, you'll hear us talk about Uncle Will a lot. He's one of our favorite people. He was our teacher. He's one of our best friends. He was our homie. Like, he was our mentor. Like, there was a lot that our relationship was with him.
I love it so much. And then let's go to Atman Smith. Tell us about yourself.
Well, Atman Smith from Baltimore. And just to build off of what Ollie was saying, one of the main foundations of what we do is the yoga and meditation, but it's about being an entrepreneur as well. You know, our father pushed all three of us, Andy and, you know, Ollie and myself. Me and Ollie are brothers. Andy's a brother from another. And, you know, after college, you know, our dad told us if we move into our childhood house in West Baltimore, in the middle of the hood, in the epicenter where all the Freddie Gray stuff happened, that he would financially take care of us if we became entrepreneurs. You know, he saw a lot of his older relatives, you know, give their heart and soul to their career. And then at the end of it, their jobs just kicked them to the curb and, you know, didn't honor a lot of agreements that a lot of benefits and, you know, a lot of other things. And, you know, whenever they wanted to, they could just fire his relatives. So he knew that he didn't want us to go that route. And one thing he used to always stress to us is that, you know, you want to be the check and not earn the check. And, you know, we didn't know how we were going to become entrepreneurs. We just knew that, you know, we wanted to work for ourselves. We wanted to help the planet. And, you know, our dad wasn't too excited that, you know, we wanted to go the nonprofit route when we became entrepreneurs. But, you know, that's what materialized out of our minds and hearts was, you know, creating a nonprofit to be able to help. It started off as underserved communities. Now, you know, we help anybody and everybody. And, you know, the reason why we got into that, we saw this commercial where there was this guy named Matthew Lesko. And, you know, he had a whole bunch of questions on his. He looked like a mad scientist. And we were in my crib reading books and, you know, looking at documentaries. And there was a commercial on and it was him. And he was like, do you want the government to pay for you to write a book, to do this, to do that? We looked at each other like, holy shit, that's what we're going to do. We're going to get the government to pay for us to save the planet. And, you know, in our mind, you know, that's what was going to happen. We were going to save the planet. And, you know, that's kind of it. We've been doing our part to try to ease the chaos and the trauma that's going on in the world through our work. And, you know, I think the other cool part about what we do is we create jobs for folks. Like, you know, a lot of people that may not have opportunities to work a legal 9-to-5 and earn, you know, financial independence, they do that with us. You know, we teach them about financial literacy, teach them professionalism and a lot of other things that go into making a successful employee. And, you know, we provide those people with financial independence and they're able to support themselves, support their families, and inspire their peers to come work for us as well.
That's so inspiring. Let's go over to Andy Gonzalez.
Hey.
Andres. Yeah. Andres.
There you go. Andres. Yeah. Yeah. You say pretty good. You can roll your R. Good for you.
I'm trying. Yeah. I'm trying.
Yeah. So I'm Andres Gonzalez. Everyone calls me Andy. I met Ali and Atma, the Smith brothers, in college. So I didn't have a practice like they did earlier on in my life when I was younger. You know, I came from a Puerto Rican family. So, you know, love and family, that is really, really big in you know, our culture and in our household. So I did have that basis. And I think that that's what really echoes through as I grew up longer and longer, or as I got older and older, you know, that love was always something that was around us. And I think that's something we really focus on with Holistic Life Foundation, or just all the work that we do when we're going out and try to share these techniques. And a big reason why I got into the practice was because, you know, I was hanging out with Ali and Amma, and like they had said, you know, just to echo what they said, kind of, you know, we saw a lot of suffering in the world and we wanted to do something about it. You know, we are into comics and superheroes and stuff like that. So for us, it was easy for us to kind of envision us being these three guys that are go out there and save the world. And, you know, we learned early on that it takes way more than just three guys to pull this off. And we were lucky and blessed to have the support and resources that we did. And people always kind of had our backs and believed in us, even though, you know, for years and years and years, there were a lot of doubters and haters looking at us like, man, when are you going to get a real job? Or when are you going to really do something? Because we're just, our minds were set on, we're going to try to help people, help themselves. And I think that's ultimately what we are. Is, you know, our teacher he didn't like us calling him a teacher. He'd always say that he's a reminder, and that all of us know everything already. We just kind of forgot it, right? And if we can start getting people to remember that light within them, like the book says, and letting it shine, you know, that real infinite self of who they are, and seeing themselves in anything and everything around them, that their life changes, you know, and it's a transformation that occurs, and it makes you see the world differently and treat people differently, treat the environment differently, and understanding that we're all interconnected and that we're all one. And if we can remind people this, then hopefully it'll make it easier for us to unite and be this one entity that we all truly are. So it's been a crazy ride. I don't think when we met and we were hanging out in college, I mean, we were party animals, that we would have taken it to where we are now. You know what I mean? Like, the transformation occurred within us and we were like, man, we got to give this to everybody. And, you know, we always say to people, you know, we didn't make any of these techniques up. You know, these are things that have been around for thousands and thousands of years. We just listened to our teacher and we became scientists. And when we were introduced to a practice, we did an experiment. We did it on ourselves. We did the practice. We saw the results and we were like, damn, this does this. I'm going to keep doing this. And then we try to find another practice and we keep doing that and doing that and doing that. And so we found enough techniques that we thought, hey, these are the ones that we're really going to focus on spreading to the world. And 20 years later, here we are hanging out with you.
You know, the crazy thing is that that transformation was real. When Andy said transformation, like, it was such a drastic transformation that we did a TEDx talk at Columbia University. And afterwards, like, we threw like a little happy hour at a bar. And like all the friends that we used to party with at college, a lot of them that were in New York, they came and they hung with us. They were like, so what are you guys doing? We're like, yeah, we started this nonprofit. We teach meditation and yoga to kids. They were like, bullshit, what are y'all really doing? We were like, no. And they were like, that's what we really do. We pulled up the website on our phone and they thought we had created a fit. Like, they were just like, everyone was totally blown away that from where the people they knew at our senior year in University of Maryland College Park had slowed things down enough to be able to start a nonprofit. And then not only a nonprofit, but a nonprofit that taught yoga and meditation at that point to kids, to only kids at that point. They were blown away by that when they thought we were totally bullshitting them.
Okay, I have some thoughts to that. First of all, I really want to party with you guys someday.
We're going to make that happen. We are going to make that happen.
And second of all, I resonate with that at such a deep level. When I went back to some of my high school reunions, so something you all probably don't know about me, I was in special education as a kid for an auditory learning disability I had. They thought I was dumb for a lot of my childhood. So, you know, when I talk to some people at these reunions and I'm like, yeah, I got a PhD from Yale. They're like, what?
That's awesome.
They're like, you what? You? I was like, yeah, me. So
the dumb kid did.
The The you know, the one you bullied? Remember me? The one you beat up in the bathroom at Penguin Elementary School? So so it's just it's wonderful to give back in that way as well and be able to help those. I think all of us, all five of us, did I count right, believe in wanting to take our prior experiences using a launch pad to make sure that, like, a lot of people don't fall through the same kind of cracks that maybe we fell through. I think that, like, these days there's different paths to go. I feel like some people kind of just stay in that victimhood sort of mindset their whole lives. Like, they stay in that sort of way of thinking of, like, you know, that was my past and I'm still there, you know, and like there's no way out. And I feel like you all are kind of taking a different strategy, which is like trying to give these kids hope, you know, that they don't have to stay in that their whole lives. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's totally true. I mean, I know. Yeah. So like Ab and I grew up meditating. We meditated a lot. I was in like the fourth grade and he was in the second grade and then didn't meditate again until I guess like our junior year of college. And I know not having a practice sucked. You know what I mean? Like there was so much going on mentally and like just the life emotional roller coaster that it is. And like just everything that was going on. And like, I think getting back to my practice, I was like, oh, okay. So that's what's been missing for all this time. And I think we wanted to give that to as many people as possible. It was like when we were in our teacher's hands, like Uncle Will's hands, like later on when we were finishing up college, like it's kind of like starting over. Like, as I started practicing more, some of it started to come back to me. Like when we first sat down with him, it was like hitting the reset button and trying to learn all these practices from the beginning. And it was like such a profound change that it was like, man, we got to share this practice with everybody, like as many people as possible. Cause like, this is what people are missing in their lives. So many people that are suffering, that feel like they're isolated, that feel stressed out, that feel angry, that feel depressed, that feel sad, that feel like their life is hopeless and helpless. Mm. And it's because they don't have a connection to their true self. I mean, like, and the universe, like our teacher literally wouldn't leave the house because we would ask him, like, hey, do you want to go out and do something with us? He'd be like, well, I need to leave the house. There's a whole universe inside of me to explore. So it was like, that's what people are missing. Like, you're connected to everything, but you don't know how to get there and you don't know that it's there. So I think that's what we want to give kids, because a lot of the kids we work with in these traditionally and like historically underserved communities, like if they were only connected to their physical environment, it would be a miserable, hopeless, and helpless situation with a lot of fear, with a lot of anxiety, with a lot of anger. And why not give them something bigger to connect to? So that once they can connect to something bigger than their neighborhood, then they can start to dream on a bigger scale and do different things with their lives and live have a lot more peaceful and loving existence.
I don't think I could have said that any better.
Yeah, and going back to you were saying about you know, kids getting caught in, you know, past experiences and, you know, stuff like that kind of blocks their forward progress in life. you know, there's this quote that our teacher used to always tell us. He used to say that the past brings up fear and anger. The future brings out anxiety. Focus on the now, because that's all there really is. And I think that's one of the ways, one of the things that the kids learn and we learn through the practice is, you know, being in that present moment. And, you know, no, it's hard for anyone to ever really always be in that present moment, but it's just all about having the awareness when you do get caught up in past thoughts, whether it's a week ago, a month ago, a year ago, a decade ago, that kind of puts you in, we call it shitsville. You know what I mean? Gets you in a depressed mood, angry mood, jealous mood, which doesn't do you any good at all. Or if you're worried about the future, you know, worried about, you know, am I in the right career? Am I, you know, doing the best that I can be? Instead of just focusing on right now and excelling in whatever way you can in this present moment, you know? And I think that's what one of the things that the practices does for people is it allows them to be in that present moment, let them know when they slip and they're in the future or the past, and gives you techniques to get back, push reset on your mind and get back to that present moment. And then also, you know, physical practices, sometimes, you know, people go through trauma, get stored in the body and their body's not a safe space. You know, the physical practices that we teach helps release that trauma, makes their body a safe space. And then we go into the breathing, which kind of slows your mind down. So you can actually get the most benefit out of meditating and connecting to that universal center that Ali was talking about.
Yeah, I read somewhere that you guys want to create an oasis in the school. Can you kind of unpack what that means a little bit? And the way I see it, a big part of that is giving these kids tools to deal with the adversity in their lives, as opposed to shrinking away from it and getting disconnected from themselves. But yeah, is that in the along those lines?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just imagine when you were in school. I know when I, like, reflecting when I was in school, it's a long ass day, right? You know, they put you in there from the morning to the end, and you're supposed to just stare at teacher after teacher, learn lesson after lesson. And that can be overwhelming. And a lot of times, if at the administration and the teachers, the people in the building don't understand what's going on at home, then they're totally just not analyzing the situation seriously. So when Johnny comes to school, he hasn't eaten, he hasn't slept, he lives in an environment at home that's just so overwhelming. And then you expect him to sit there and stare at this board and listen to you. And then when he falls asleep or he's not paying attention or whatever, then he gets punished. It's like damn, this is, how do you think this is right? You know? So what we wanted to do was to create, like you said, an oasis in the school that allows the students and the staff to go there when they need to take a break, to take a moment for themselves, you know, and the goal was to make it feel completely different than the rest of the school. So when we put these rooms together, where we have the, you know, the Himalayan salt crystals, we have the oils diffusing, we have cushions and zafus and little chairs and these posters and water fountains. And just so when you walk by the room, you're like, what is going on in there? And you want to be able to kind of feel that essence of being, of peace, of tranquility when you walk into that room. And I think, you know, ultimately, wow, that's what we were trying to do. We were trying to create that space. And then when they come in and they do come into the room, that's when we can give them tools and techniques to deal with that adversity you were talking about that allows them to find that same peace and tranquility within themselves, wherever they're at, right? So, you know, give them the space in the school, get them to start understanding, hey, you can access this, you know? Like I was saying, if you stop focusing on the past and the future and you're in this present moment, you're going to notice you can really appreciate every single second of your life. And then understanding that they are going through so much, we're like, hey, I got you. Like, how about next time you're faced with this adversity, try this breathing technique and it'll pull you back to center, or try this meditation and it'll get you back to being present and in this moment. And, you know, that's the goal, is to keep kind of putting that into their heads and letting them know that they're capable of self-regulation. They're capable of bringing themselves back to center whenever they need to. And it's tough because, you know, if no one ever told you that, then you just assume that, man, life sucks and I can't deal with this shit type stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it's so easy to think that way. But yeah, what we try to do is create that feeling, and really also, you know, that program that we have, it's called our Mindful Moment Program. It really focuses on removing punitive practices. So there's a viral article that went out for a while. It was like, school changes detention to meditation. And that was our program, where instead of punishing the kid for what's going on in their lives or in the moment, you can send them to the room and we can give them tools and techniques that'll help them at that moment and for the rest of their lives.
One thing about that program, the coolest thing about that program is, like, you know, you see the kids changing, you see the school start to change. But when you look at the cold, hard numbers, like, the program works no matter where we set it up. There's a school in the center of where the Freddie Gray uprisings happen, like where they haven't had a suspension for like 7 or 8 years there. There's another school called Fort Worthington. The year before we got there, I think they had like 150 something suspensions. After year one, that number was down to around 57, I think. And after year two, the suspension number was down to 13. And no matter where we go, like, we go around and we train people to be able to do this program. So, like, if anybody wanted a program set up, we could show how to set it up the right way, show them the paperwork, everything, the referral rules, how to track the data, and it will work on reducing suspension numbers. It's helped with ACT scores. It's helped with attendance. It's helped reducing fights at schools. But I think the coolest thing is the energy of the school changes. The first place we started this program, the school called Patterson High School with Vance Benton, Dr. Vance Benton now, who's our brother. Yeah. He's a real good dude. He set us up with the program. We knew we were in the right place. And we walked into the principal's office, into his office, and he mentioned he said a Yoda quote, and we're huge Star Wars fans. So it was like, all right, we're in the right place. So this is our school, and we went there. The program went well, and then it was just like, you know, all the numbers got better. But he noticed one thing, that he went to another school, and he could feel the friction and the tension and the anger in the air. And then he went back to his school, and he could feel the calmness at his school. And he was like, huh, maybe there's more to this program than just these numbers. Like, energetically, my school feels a lot different than the schools where this program isn't.
Yeah, I remember another story that he told us, just an observation. Like, things don't happen overnight, but, you know, we changed the school culture with having that program implemented in school. But he said, we have a number of staff staffing the room all during the school day, but sometimes they have to go out and work with some of the teachers or the administrators or entire classes. So, you know, on very rare occasions, the room is empty and it's locked and kids can't go in there, even if they're in crisis, because we don't have anybody staffing it. He said that one day when he was coming into the school, he saw a kid who was in crisis just walk to the door. It was locked. So he sat down and just started doing his breathing and meditating and, you know, getting himself back to homeostasis. You know, that's the beauty of the practices. You know, it allows kids to learn the tools to be able to self-regulate. And one thing he was like, man, you know, that definitely wouldn't have happened in my school like 3 years ago, because like 3 years ago, if somebody saw a kid sitting down with his eyes closed, they might have just kicked him in the head and or punched him or something. But now, because there is a culture of everybody knowing what that is, it's just regular. It's just normal part of our day, is that, you know, people do have these contemplative practices interwoven into our school. And like Ali was saying, there's so many different ways that this program, and Andy was saying too, that this program helps the school climate. It helps teachers that, you know, have burnout. We had this one teacher that hated our program, and we knew he did in year one, because every time we would go into the principal's office, it would be a whole group of teachers talking, him being one of the main ones. And then when we get up there, they would all be silent. We're like, man, we know you're talking about us. But eventually, you know, we have besides the room, we have a mindfulness practice that's played over the loudspeaker at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. And he was one of the teachers where, you know, they weren't really engaged in that practice. It was supposed to be a school-wide practice. And he actually used to turn the volume down. And, you know, he would just be like, man, don't pay attention to that. And then Andy went in there one day and he actually led the class through the practices, even though, you know, the teacher wasn't really feeling it. He allowed Andy to do that. And, you know, when the students started disrespecting the teacher, Andy had the teacher's back and was like, look, man, y'all learning. I think they were learning CAD stuff, right, Andy?
Yeah, CAD stuff. Yeah.
And, you know, he was telling me, he's like, man, you all are learning a skill that is going to help the employability of your life. You know, like, you all need to take this serious. This guy is a wealth of information. Y'all need to give him respect. And, you know, just reasoning with these kids about why they should respect their teacher, it kind of shifted the energy in his classroom. And the teacher, you know, felt like he was respected and actually seen. And it made him start actually doing the practice and participating. And that dude went from he would tell us, I can't wait to retire. I'm getting out of here this year. I can't stand these kids. To 10 years later, he's still teaching because he has a contemplative practice. And, you know, he went from wearing all black clothes to wearing like floral print shirts and giving us huge hugs. And, you know, so the program not only helps the students, but it helps the teachers and administrators as well.
Wow. And that works both ways as well. So the teachers having more respect for the students, even the maybe the trouble students. You talk about the reciprocal teaching model. Could you kind of talk, elucidate a little more on what that means?
Yeah, when our teacher taught us, when we went to him and asked, when we were the first time went to Uncle Will, we were like, hey, can you teach us this yoga stuff? He was like, I don't want no devotees. I'm only teaching teachers. He believed in teaching people to be able to share the practice with others. It was all about former Black Panther. He was about empowerment. We wanted to empower us with the practice so that we could use it to teach other people. And I think that informed the way that we taught. We didn't even know it was reciprocal teaching until our buddy Heather actually told us that we were using reciprocal teaching. So then we started using the term reciprocal teaching, but mm-hmm. It was like what we knew, like, hey, like we need to empower these kids with the practice. We need to show them how to do this. So they can share it with other people. So we would bring the kids to the front and they would lead the practice. So like when people come visit our after school program, they wouldn't see any of the three of us up there leading the practices. It would be little kids up there leading the bending, the stretching, the breathing, the meditations. They'd be leading all of it and they would be killing it. And then they would go home. Actually, we didn't even know that they were doing this until parents started coming up to us. Like one little girl's mom came in and said, I thought y'all were doing yoga. I didn't know y'all were doing breathing and meditation. Because one day I came home all stressed out. My daughter sat me down and said, Mom, you need to breathe and meditate with me. Because she looked stressed out and she helped her. She breathed and meditated. There was another little girl whose grandmother's stomach was upset. She taught her to do a breathing exercise that settled her stomach. And the list of stories goes on. So it was like, we wanted to empower the kids with the practice. So like, I mean, we always say, if we can go to school and work with 200 kids, that's awesome. But if we can turn those 200 kids into 200 teachers, then we make a huge impact and the ripples go out infinitely.
Wow, that's some profound stuff. Another phrase you use is involution. What's that?
Involution. All right. So, you know, our teacher, you know, like Ali said, he was a Black Panther and, you know, they went to revolution. And, you know, one thing that he would say is, you know, violence begets violence. You know, the only way that you can really make a true change in society is going within yourself and involving. Like our book says, let your light shine. And the only way to do that is with these practices, tapping into that universal center. That's the same as my universal center. That's the same as yours. And it's like, once you start, like Ali always says, start your day in the light, end your day in the light. That's what involution is about, is trying to be in your light as much as possible. Then it makes it that much easier to kind of think on a higher vibration. And that's what the involution is about, is going in ways and then dealing with the world from that inner view outwards.
Yeah, because you really can't change the outside world, but for so much, you know what I mean? Like you may be able to rearrange your house or like, you know what I mean? Put a garden in your lawn. There's not huge shifts that you can make on the outside, but if enough people move from their higher self, then you can change the whole world. I mean, so that's what that involution is about. They would also say that evolution took too long. Like for us to evolve would take a long, long, long time. Like the revolutions were violent. So if everybody went inward and had an involution and worked from their light instead of from their ego, then the world would be a much better place. Wow.
This is really so important. There are systemic injustices, right? There's systemic racism. Someone could listen to what you're saying and say like, well, shouldn't we, a lot of people create this false dichotomy, right? That it's like, well, shouldn't we just focus on all of that first and not worry, you know, it's a privilege to worry about involution. This is not my belief. This is not my belief, but I'm just saying like someone, what do you say to someone who thinks in such black and white terms where they say that to you? How do you respond to that?
Like, that's the most important thing going on when in your human existence is touching the universal self. You know what I mean? Like, you can do all these.
Oh, I know what you mean.
I know you know what I mean. It's like, I feel like that.
I feel you, brother.
Like, what else are we here for? Like, we're here to express our universal self, whether we do it this time or in 10 lifetimes or 100 lifetimes. You know what I mean? Like, that's the goal of being a human. Like, you experience the highs and lows of being a human. You experience all the feels. You experience everything that there is to offer with gratifying your senses. And none of it makes you happy. Like, you end up miserable trying to go outward. But, like, the whole thing is about touching your true self, experiencing it, letting it shine, not just on your meditation cushion or on your mat, but like out into the world so you can inspire yourself and inspire other people. So all that stuff is important because we are humans. Like, you can't ignore it. It's not going to go anywhere. But at the same time, the most important thing is touching your true self, like touching your light and experiencing it and letting it shine.
In society nowadays, it's like, it's so common for everyone to be focused on that external, you know, on the outside. And Correct. It's almost like we've been brainwashed to think these things. Like, I know when I was younger, to me, God was in the clouds. He wasn't even attainable, right? He's like so outside and far away from me that, and the only way I could have a relationship was through a certain person with him. Like, I needed a middleman to be able to get me to communicate with these type of things. And when you start really seeing the world for what it is and beyond this external stuff, and you start going inward, that's where the real stuff is. That's where the truth is. That's like your real self, you know? And it's amazing to me how often people are so focused on, like Ali was saying, on the material, on the senses, on the ego. And those are parts of you, but that's not your real, real thing. You know, Uncle Will used to always say, like, all this out here is an illusion, you know, and we need to keep removing the veils of the illusion that we're seeing to identify with what we really, really are and who we really are and work on that part of ourselves, you know, because the light within us is in everything that there is in all existence. And it's just muddled by ignorance, you know, and not ignorance like calling someone dumb, but ignoring the truth of who you really are, of your real infinite, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent self. And when one realizes that, then they start to learn to love themselves more. That helps them learn to love other people more. And if you can work on that, like I always, you know, lately I've been thinking a lot about this, like, you know, wow, it'd be great to solve all these issues and problems with this external world. And maybe that's the way we need to go to make stuff better. But if everyone just learned to love and take care of themselves, wouldn't that make the world better too? Right? You know, like if everyone focused on being the best version of themselves, then you're solving all the issues on the outside world, because now there's not as many douchebags and assholes because you're working on yourself and you're seeing yourself in everyone and everything. And it's just all love then.
That's so good. I also love your vocabulary because it's that I used when I was a kid. I used to call people douchebags, and if you were cool, you were my homie, you know, like the kind of, you're bringing back words from my 90s youth. So,
man, we were meant to hang. I'm telling you, buddy, we were meant to hang.
Yes. I believe that's true. I believe that's true. We all have a mutual friend. We should give a shout out to Sharon Salzberg.
Sharon, we love you.
Do you remember Raise the Roof thing too? Do you remember that from the 90s? Oh, yeah. Do you remember that? Remember that? Sharon Salzberg. I adore her. She's
doing the stir to mix it too. I don't think
I'm doing it all.
She definitely has the most infectious laugh that, you know, we've ever been around. If she starts giggling, it will like tickle you. Yes. You know what I mean? It'll make you just giggle and put you into that light inside of yourself. That's, you know, she's one of our favorite people on the planet.
I remember one thing about when we first started, like when people started paying attention to us, and we started going to all these conferences like around the country, we would hear all these people who were like supposedly these profound spiritual teachers speak. And we were so like underwhelmed with most of them. We were like, this isn't. But Sharon was the first person we saw that spoke. We saw her at the yoga service conference at the Omega Institute. And I'll never forget it. Like, we were looking at each other like, holy shit, like this lady is amazing. Like, she was the first person to actually talked about love. She talked about connection. The way she taught was very, like Atman said, her laugh was infectious. The way she taught was amazing. And it was just like from that very first moment we saw her speak, we were like, this lady is amazing. It would be amazing to learn from her. At that point, we weren't even thinking about teaching with her. Like, but then like she approached, like she's opened up a lot of doors for us, but I think just she's one of the most profound teachers that we've ever come in contact with. And it's cool to teach with her because every time I teach with her, I become a better teacher myself. Just seeing the way that she tells stories, the way that she interacts with everyone, the way that she engages, and the way that she shares about her practice.
I just see such a great confluence between the work she does and her conceptualization of love and what you all are bringing into the world. And the light you're shining is so, it's so clear, that connection there. There's someone else that I wanted to bring up and see if you know her. I'm a big fan of Rhonda McGee's work, and I don't know if you've come across her work at all, The Inner Work of Racial Justice.
That's another one of our homies.
She's a homie too? Man, I want to be a homie. You guys.
You're one of our homies too now, buddy. You're part of the fam.
I mean, unbelievable squad we have here. Yeah. We got Rhonda, Sharon, you three. We could do a whole TV show on that. I'm so glad, you know, Rhonda, she's been on this podcast and she's become a friend of mine. And I see a very complimentary between her view of kind of that light shines outward from within, right? As opposed to, blaming everything on the outside world, right?
Whenever we are at a conference with her, we always get a chance to sit down and just hang with her. And she's another one of those people that are just so real, and the work she's doing is so needed in the world. And
yeah,
and she's, you know, it's few and far between when you meet those authentic, genuine people with big hearts who really care, who are brilliant too, you know, like geniuses, and they just profound. So whenever we get a chance to hang with her, we always sit down and chat, and she's awesome. She really is.
I agree. There's another quality to you three that I really like that I think is sorely lacking in the world today. I think all of your qualities that I'm seeing today are sorely lacking, but one that I want to call out in particular is fun. You three seem like a lot of fun, and I noticed in your book, you say, we want students to have fun. And I think that's actually really profound. You know, like, you don't hear that much from education books. They're all so serious. You know, they're like, our learning theory is about pouring X into... It's like, shut the fuck up. Like, what does it mean to actually let the kids enjoy school? Would that be such a terrible thing?
The teachers that mean something to you in your lifetime, that, you know, there's lots of teachers that you've forgotten, but those teachers that actually, you know, they taught you stuff, but you had fun in their class. Those are the ones that have a lasting impression in your mind. And, you know, our teacher always told us, man, if your class ain't laughing, then you ain't doing shit. You know what I mean? So we try to infuse humor into everything that we do, just to lighten up the mood. That's an easy way to get people into their light. And then, you know, dive deep into the rabbit hole of this thing we call contemplative practices.
Yes. You all are interested in yoga, right? And you're interested in applying a lot of yoga principles. You know, there's like this stereotype of like, when I think yoga, you think like white blonde girl, like in yoga pants. Like, yeah. I don't know if I should be editing out what I'm saying right now, but I'm just trying to keep it real.
No, that's truth.
Nah, keep it real. Keep it real.
Okay, good, good. I tend to do that on my podcast, so I'll be consistent and keep it real. What I'm trying to say is there's like a societal sort of stereotype of the yoga practitioner in America. Now, it's not at all like the original roots of the point of yoga, right? But you tend to think of like, you know, oh, you know, like, we're doing this to, you know, you are greatness. You are believe in yourself, you know. But I think in a lot of ways, you three are not white blonde yoga chicks in yoga pants.
What?
And you say? Yeah, I don't. That's not what I'm perceiving right now. You know, so like, yeah, you three are interested in yoga. So, but my point is like, maybe you three, maybe it's important to expand. This is my point. Stay with me, folks. Stay with me. Maybe we can expand our notion of yoga beyond this kind of superficial stereotype that we have in our society. Kind of even get to maybe the roots of what the point of yoga was in the first place. That was my point.
I mean, honestly, I think if we would have gone that yoga studio, Lululemon yoga pant route, we wouldn't have been into the practice. I know.
Exactly, so you know what I'm saying. Yeah.
I'm there with you. But okay. We learned from, again, I learned meditation as a little kid from my dad, got deep, deep, deep into the practice with Uncle Will. From East, they lived in East Baltimore. Like, I mean, it didn't, you know what I mean? It didn't do much more in Baltimore than Uncle Will. So, I mean, like, went to Dunbar, you know what I mean? Like, went to University of Maryland Eastern Shore. He was like a very, very Baltimore dude. And like, that's who we learned from. Actually, the crazy thing was, we didn't even realize how white the yoga world was until we went to the Garrison Institute for a conference. Like, cause you know, we learned from them. We taught in Baltimore City, which is the second most segregated city behind Milwaukee. And so it was like, we were teaching black kids, and then we go to the Garrison Institute and we walk in and everybody else there was white. And we were like, what? And like, this is what yoga is? Like, it definitely threw us forward. But then we started looking more and looking at Yoga Journal and all these other things, we saw how white the yoga world was, but it was a shock to us that that's what it looked like, because that wasn't our experience with it. Like, even when me and Ivan went to the church we grew up in, there were other kids of color that were in that church meditating with us. So it wasn't like it just seemed weird, but it's definitely something that's a practice for everyone. It's not for one group. It's not for just somebody. Like, price wise, it may be just for one group, but like I think that's one of the things that we wanted to do is make it accessible to everyone. Like, the programs we do in schools, the schools pay for it, but it's always free to the kids and the families. So we want everyone to be able to use these practices. Everybody is dealing with stress and anxiety and fear, like all these things that are part of the human experience. And yoga is a beautiful practice to help you kind of mitigate a lot of those problems. You know what I mean? And get some stillness. Like, I think the two biggest things that the kids we work with get out of the practice are stillness and connection. Like, a lot of them don't have a place for peace in their lives, whether it's in their mind, whether it's in their home, whether it's in their school, in their community. There's no peace anywhere. And they don't have the money to go to a yoga class or go on a retreat. They don't have the money for that. So we show them how to get to that place of peace within them that's always there and they can always retreat to. And that connection, like, we learned the kids weren't connected to themselves at all and they didn't love themselves at all. So it was just like it's always good to see that light bulb go off and kids shift the way that they see themselves in the world when they connect to themselves. And then once they connect to themselves and love themselves, then it starts to spill outward. Like, you see them become more compassionate, empathetic, more loving towards their friends. They're less violent. They're less impulsive. All these things are going on just from that connection and that place of inner peace. So the practices are for everybody. I think another thing is like kids seeing us teaching the practices and our teachers teaching the practices makes them shift the way that they feel about yoga. Because, I mean, a lot of them probably would think that it was a practice for middle-aged white ladies. You know what I mean? Like, that's what they would think. But I think seeing us in there doing it, like, a lot of the kids now, like, the kids that we were working with, like, when you ask them what they wanted to be, like, they would say, I want to be a yoga teacher. I want to help people like you all do. And I don't think that's something they would feel was accessible if they didn't see people looking like them teaching and doing the practice.
Dude, I really think it's cool how we're kind of breaking down that image and that stereotype with a lot of, you know, because we're bringing, you know, people to places that you wouldn't see people like us leading the exercises. I remember once being at the Omega Institute, we had like a lot of our younger students with us. I don't know if fellas, y'all remember this, but remember, like, we walk in and like security came up to us and they're like, ho, what are y'all doing here? And like, one of our young duns had gold fronts in. Remember that? Kwame had gold fronts in. He's like, oh no, we're the yoga instructors. And you can tell the security guy's like, what? Like, but again, you know, like, that we can do that. You know, we can break down that idea that it's just supposed to be, you know, middle-aged white women or blonde white women that teach this yoga stuff. That no, we have, you know, because the majority of our staff are minorities. So we're coming in and we look nothing like what everyone else does. And then when we come in and we even do it different, you know, so like, they're more, a lot of times, that's why I don't think it would have worked if we went to those type of classes, because it's always like, okay, and here is what we're going to do. And they're in like, they expect like this white robed guru image type stuff. And nah, we come in with our superhero t-shirts and we are who we are. We keep it real. We're ourselves.
A beard, not dreadlocks.
There you go. Right. Yeah. Right.
Exactly. Right. Right. You know that's what people expect. A beard, but they don't expect dreadlocks. Yeah. No, I'm with you.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's so great that we can do that, that we can change. And it's still tough sometimes, you know. I think we're not the only ones that are surprised. They're surprised too, because, you know, countless times Ali Ottman and I have gone to a conference. We'll be the keynote. Our picture will be on the back behind the person checking people in as keynote speakers. And we'll walk up and they'll be like, oh, y'all must be the band. And we're like, oh my God. Fucking band. We have no instruments on us. You know, but they're just not used to seeing that. And we play along crazy. With it. You would love it. We have so much fun. So we're an Aboriginal folk band, is what we say when people make this comment. Who plays the bull roarer? Is it Ottman or Ali? And Ottman plays the didgeridoo, I'm on vocals. So that's what we'll tell them. And then when we get on stage and we start leading the meditation, you can see the person like in the crowd like, oh, I can't believe I called them.
I would probably mess with them. I'd probably mess with them even more than that, though. I'd probably be like, yeah, we're the rappers here. You know, we're here to sit, you know, sing like, you know, and then like say some really vulgar lyrics.
We do. Yeah, we do. But we cover two live crew.
Yeah. Yeah. Like something like that, you know, like, yeah. We're, you know, cause sometimes when people have the stereotypes, I just like to mess with it. Right. And just like go all the way, you know, but no, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Another thing that I love from your book is you talk about how love and empathy need to be consistent and reliable. I feel like that's a big principle with a lot of the work you do. Can you kind of expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think it started, I don't even think we realized how important it was. I think it was two things. One we just talked about the other day, but like when we, after we finished, like we started with a group of fifth graders at Windsor Hills Elementary School, and then one of them, who actually teaches for us now to this day, and this was like 2002 when he was 20 years ago, he was a fifth grader, now he works for us. But he was like, all right, it's nice to know you guys. We're like, nice to know you. We're going to be in your life forever. And he just got this confused look on his face. Like, you guys are going to be, but we literally have been because he still works for us to this day. So like, we definitely believe that consistency is key. Like, because a lot of people don't have consistency, especially consistent, like people who are present and like treat them with love and respect. They don't really have that in their lives. So we always felt that that was important. So like, we were there all the time when we were working with our students. We try to, when we have a staff person at a school, we try to keep that person consistent year to year so they can build that bond with the kids. And actually, we were in Madison earlier this week. And the first time we ever left Baltimore to not have the after school program was when we did a 3-day program up at Abraham Lincoln Elementary School up in Madison. And when we got back that next Monday, the kids were like, oh, you guys got locked up, huh? You're like, what do you mean we got locked up? You know, like, and they were like, I mean, why else would you guys not be here at the after school program? Like, you guys are here every day. So it was just like, that would be the only thing, that the reason they would see we weren't there, and they knew we loved them and cared about them so much that they would expect it. But consistency is the key. Like, I mean, like it helps those kids to break down. Like, a lot of kids have walls built up because they don't have people who are consistent. Like, they may have a teacher that cared about them. You know, but teachers get burnt out. They might transfer, or they go to the next grade, and the next teacher might not. Or they might have a mentor, a mentoring program that might be around for a little while, and they might disappear. But, I mean, we're with our kids. Like, they're kids that go from our elementary school, I mean, our after-school program, to our mentoring program, to a workforce development program, and then workforce. So there's just kids that we've known pretty much their entire lives that are working for us now. And even the kids that don't work for us, some of them have worked for us, and they're doing other things now. Others still stay in contact with us. So they know that we're, like, even our cell phone numbers. I have the same cell phone number since, like, 1997. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, they know how to find us. They know how to track us down. So it's like they know that they're going to get consistency from us. And it's important. I mean, it's important in relationships.
And love, too. I know you mentioned love. Love is, I mean, we always say it's the most powerful force in the universe. And our teacher, every time I hear love, I can always see him being saying like L-O-V-E, L-O-V-E, the way he would say it. And he would just, for us, that's a big thing of who we are, is, you know, seeing the light, knowing that there's that light within you, seeing it in everyone else, and then loving them because they're just you. And I think that that's something we really embody. And people say to us sometimes when the three of us walk into a room or a conference, that they can feel the love like exuding from us, permeating out of our beings. And we used to say, you know, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make love zombies, you know, that we're trying to infect people.
I love
with
that
love,
chapter.
Right. So that chapter, they can go out and infect more people, and we can keep just spreading this love throughout the world. And the more and more the love happens, the easier it is to see it, to witness it, to be engulfed by it. You know, I have one phrase Uncle Weiss always say, he's like, is it, you know, the world's like an ocean of love, and you can like dip your toe in it. You can take a sip of it, or you can just dive right in. I feel like we're the type that we just dive right in.
I love that so much. I think we probably should end on that note. It's such a beautiful tone. Unless any of you want to add to that. I bet. Yeah. No. Okay. So then let's end on that. And I just want to thank you all so much for coming to my podcast. I liked you guys instantly. And I love your soul, and I love your way of being in this world. It's just incredible. It's it resonates at such a great frequency. So I just want to encourage you to keep doing the work you're doing, and let me know how I can help.
Yeah, man. Awesome. Yeah, thank you, man. Awesome to be here, bro. For real. Likewise, what you said right away, just, you know, when we were just before setting up, just laughing and talking, like, this dude is super cool. We got to hang when we are around you. We're going to make sure we link up, and we're going
to
party.
I'd love to.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.